Woo! Welcome to the Some Work All Play podcast. We are so happy to be with you today.
Happy Tuesday.
It's Tuesday.
And the creative juices are flowing over here on this Tuesday.
Megan, I'm a little bit nervous when you say the word juice to start the podcast with our history of fluids on this episode, but what are you thinking?
Well, I'm thinking that your creative juices are flowing and I'm just like tapping into that sweet, sweet nectar.
In what way are my creative juices flowing?
Okay, because you're writing a freaking novel.
Oh my God, you're starting it off with that?
Yeah, because that's like the coolest shit in the world. How would you not start a podcast off with that?
Well, it means the world to me. We've talked on here before about I've always wanted to write a novel. We were considering even writing one together. But just out of the blue, last Wednesday, I woke up in the middle of the night with an idea fully formed and fleshed out that I'd never thought about before. It's sci-fi, it's comedy, it's a little bit of philosophy. It might be totally bad, but I started writing a few hundred words a day, and we're pretty far into it at this point.
Yeah, I love that you're saying we, because like my involvement in this novel is yesterday I like heard it for the first time. So yeah. I was in the bathtub after an elliptical workout, and it was like one of the best moments of my life. I was sitting there post-workout, like full of endorphins, and you come in and you just read me this novel that's like a mic drop. And it was just amazing.
Did you like it? Did you like how it started?
Oh, it's so good. I mean, first of all, your first sentence is a banger. It's good. And like the first sentence is a lot of pressure. But I don't know. I mean, I feel like I've never laughed. How many words do you have? Like 1,600?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah. I feel like I've never laughed as much within 1,600 words. But yet I'm also captivated by the plot too. So it's a good combo.
See, yeah. You know what the key is?
What?
You did it right after an elliptical workout. Yeah. So your brain chemicals were flowing so well.
I know. If you read me like Leo's book that's red fish, blue fish, one fish, two fish, I'd be like, so good, such a banger.
Mic drop. You said there was going to be a red fish, but then there was a blue fish. Talk about a twist. M. Night Shyamalan's writing these children's books nowadays. Well, thank you for being a part of the process. The reason I said we is why I wanted to read it to you is because after each section, I'm asking you about, okay, this is where it's going to go tomorrow, because I'm writing just little chunks because that's all I have time for right now. And I'm holding myself accountable to it. And you've been like instrumental in development of the plot and some of the themes and mainly just giving me a tailwind, because it's just like having a running coach or anyone along your journey athletically. Like, it's kind of a vulnerable thing. Even if no one ever reads this novel, it's weird to write a novel having never done it, even though I've written a lot. And having you respond that way, naked in the bathtub, is something I'll never forget. It was great.
Were you like scared to read it? Like, how did you feel reading that? I mean, yeah. I was like blown away by it. So like, I feel like if I were the one that wrote it, I'd be like, yo, listen up. This is going to be good. Like, how did you feel reading it?
Terrible. Yeah. And granted, I know you're always a great audience, but because it's just a different style of writing and it's very weird, I would say. At least like it's a little different than some of the other things I've read in the past. So we'll see. The plan, actually, what I'd like to do here is release it as a serialized audio format on Patreon just for feedback and things.
Okay, like, this is what you want to do. I kind of think it's a bad idea.
Why?
I think you should, I mean, okay, so I believe in this really deeply and I think it has the chance to do well.
So we should shop it to like Columbia Pictures to see if they want to make a movie first?
Well, I just like, I think you should give yourself the room and space to like edit and grow. And I mean, if people are going to give you feedback, but I think you should create first for you. And then like maybe at the end of the process, do that. But I think like doing it as like, I don't know, installments one by one is a little much.
But Megan, then we get more Patreon subscribers.
Yeah. Okay. But invest in yourself.
Or maybe we lose Patreon subscribers.
Well, maybe that too. Yeah. But also invest in yourself, because maybe this is a bestseller. Yeah. And it wouldn't be if you were just trying to like get some more Patreon subscribers.
Well, we'll see. So just a little hint is that it includes the abyss.
We haven't gotten to the abyss yet.
No.
Not in the first 1,600 words. How did you have the constraint? Like, this is not usually your type of constraint.
We're going to have so much death in this book. It's going to just be death. So like funny death is going to be all throughout. So just wait. It's going to be kind of an interesting journey.
It's actually hilarious so far. Yeah. And we're going to have to control F death. But what I love.
Control F death.
Yes. Just see how many. What's your prediction? Put a number out.
Of how many deaths there's going to be?
How many? No. Like how many times you write the word death?
Oh, I don't think too much, because I'm never going to say it directly. It's just going to be like shit goes down and then it happens.
Okay, so we're going to need synonyms. It's going to have to be like the abyss, the great happening. We'll have to like see what happens.
It's also a good lesson. If someone gives you a story of your life, probably the first thing you should do is control F death. Control F death? Control F sex.
Oh, true.
And then you'll be really set up to understand how your life unfolds.
That's a well-lived life.
Yeah.
I would want that in my obituary. Be like, let's control F sex in our obituary and see what it says. Okay. But you know what is arousing is the way that you like have enthusiasm for the writing process.
Yeah, just heard the process of it.
Yeah, you love it. You have this external keyboard right now, which, what type of keyboard is that?
It's a Magic Keyboard from Apple, because my actual Apple keyboard has shat the bed. Yet again, I break keyboards like it's nobody's business. Yeah. What is wrong with me? I don't know how I'm typing or what, but this keyboard's supposed to be indestructible, and it absolutely is 100% destructible. It has seen the abyss.
Well, I'm kind of sad it's seen the abyss, because I want the Magic Keyboard, because I'm a big fan of cause and effect.
Yeah.
And I feel like when you write on the Magic Keyboard, there's so much effect going into the keys. Yeah. Like there's like this, almost this like rebound stroke that happens.
Ooh, and rebound strokes.
Yeah. I know you talked about my butt last week, and you used the like, you like referred to as bam, bam. And I feel like when you're writing this novel, you're just hitting the A key like bam.
Bam, bam, bam.
Death, yeah. Death.
So we'll keep you updated. It's a lot like running, a little bit at a time. Hopefully it adds up to something. But even if it doesn't, I'm enjoying it. And I'm very curious to see, you know, how I grow in the process. My guess is it turns into one of those things that I never finish, but I hope to, and I hope to share it on Patreon against Megan's wishes. So if you're at all interested in that journey, I'm going to share any insights I get, patreon.com/swap, S-W-A-P. We're also going to be answering listener questions today from Patreon on here. We do a bonus podcast every week, and Science Corner post just on Patreon. So check that out.
Well, you better be finishing it, at least for my ass. I'm like very invested in it at this point.
You want to know what happens?
And the way that you're rolling out. So we did this like first chunk while I was in the bathtub post elliptical, and it was great. Yeah. And then each night you're going to read me the words, and you're trying to aim for like a minimum of 300 words a day. And so I don't know. I'm excited for the nightly readings.
The key is I'm going to give you a massage first and then read it to you.
Ooh, I like this.
I need your brain in the right place to give me the right feedback for my personality, which is no feedback at all.
Yeah, I actually haven't really, as I was like going to sleep last night, I was like, should I give any like, I mean, it's amazing. I don't have constructive feedback at this point, but will you be open to it?
100% from you?
Yeah. Okay. Actually, here's one, my one piece of feedback.
Oh, no.
We'll do this live on air. It's a touch. So it's a sci-fi like novel, and it's a touch autobiographical to the point where, do you think it could be weird to have these like like kind of like hybrid quasi autobiographical characters going into this like sci-fi world?
No, I kind of want to see how we'd respond.
I like that.
In totally different circumstances. Because the thing is, I'm not experienced as a novel writer. I know how I want my characters to respond in sci-fi movies and or novels. And every single time I read these things, I'm like, that's not the right decision. That's not what we should do. That's not how normal people would act. So I want to write a novel that's basically SWAT podcast, but in like a world where everything changes for lots of interesting reasons and includes a lot of the abyss.
I like that. A world in which there's no rules.
Yes.
Yes.
That's the most fun thing about fiction that I've never explored before, is that when I write a short article or when we talk on the podcast, there's at least some rules. But whenever you're creating something, anything can happen at any time. You're totally unbound by any laws. This is my dream, Megan.
I'm so excited. I kind of want to gift you a whiteboard and just have the whiteboard diagrams of the novel like hanging out in our kitchen so I can see where this is progressing. Like I feel like right now, like you're not really like a whiteboard or an outline type of person. Like it all exists within your brain, but I don't have access to it. And it's like, I kind of want this sneak peek whiteboard.
Okay. Well, that's coming up soon. But first, we have the most fun episode for you today. We're going to get into some cool science topics, a ton of training today. Starting off with how Threshold feels through Megan's experiences, talk about big lunches through my experience, some training talk there, explaining tempo running, which is the big science deep dive, answering some listener questions, one on gender and training volume, one on NSAIDs, so non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs and bone health, then talking about sex and training. Finally, some topics like AI in medicine, creatine supplementation, cold acclimation, and possibly more. We have so much fun stuff in this outline, but we just wasted a lot of time talking about my 1600 word start of a novel.
Okay, it wasn't wasted. It's going to be a bestseller, and I don't think I don't think there's going to be more.
Do you think it's going to be a bestseller?
I actually do.
Okay.
Yeah, you said last night.
This is the college fund.
You put like a very low percentage on it last night, and I was like, where's your belief?
Okay, well, I don't care about that right now.
Yeah.
Right now, I'm just trying to make you laugh each night.
Well, I like, it's like, it is a very similar, you referred to it earlier as kind of almost like this journey of like running or journey of training.
Yeah.
And the first day you wrote 300 words, and then the next day you erased like 290 of those, except for the first sentence. And I feel like that is a lot like marathon training. Some days you stack a brick and other days you shit a brick.
Well, speaking of shitting a brick, what a good segue to your bike crash last week.
Yeah. Ouch. Burn.
The best part about this. So Megan has been cross training a lot. You're absolutely crushing the journey. You're such a fantastic cyclist. Like you're an Olympic level cyclist. And you know, based on my experience in that sport. But you were out there, and the night before we had talked about this one Strava segment on a climb.
You were kind of like egging me on, and you're like, Megan, this is perfect for you.
No, I said, I said, with a road bike, you're out there on your gravel bike. And sure enough, Megan comes in the door much earlier than expected, covered in blood. Yeah. Her helmet was dented. It was just really rough. And I was like, oh, what happened? Was that on a turn? Was that on anything? Then I go to her Strava, and what I see is this speed chart with wattage. So she's putting out like 400 watts, 350 watts, all of a sudden, 0 watts. So going up a straight hill, somehow you ate shit and didn't get the Strava segment as a result.
I know, it was so embarrassing. Granted, it was a straight hill that was very, so the gravel was like chonky and kind of gnarly gravel.
Oh,
so
I'm sure, yeah.
I know, I have to like paint that picture for myself. I'm like, the mountain was so big.
I like it, it's chonky gravel that tons of cars drive on all the time.
I know. Well, I got very intimate with physics because I went from 400 watts to 0 watts quite fast. But the way, so it was a Strava segment. And here's my beef with biking Strava segments is like with running, the ground is much more like it's a level playing field in terms of like, there's no such thing as like, you know, you have this like huge giant tailwind like you get in cycling or draft, or like for me, this hill, it was a 2 minute hill in the segment that I wanted. You could either take a downhill into it or you could take an uphill into it. And so I decided to like go up and create the downhill into the segment. And so I hit the base at 35 miles an hour.
Which is when I thought you would have crashed.
I know.
But no, you didn't crash till you had decelerated a good bit to like 20.
Yeah. And I was like, gee, this road's in bad shape. I don't think I remembered how bad of a shape this was. And then I got out of the saddle and put out 400 watts. Yeah. And I think my like rear wheel slipped on that chonky gravel. But then I remember nothing from there.
Yeah.
Like, you know how people describe their falls and they're like, I went to the lift and then over my handlebar and then this happened. I literally, all I know is I was at 400 watts and then I was at 0 watts and then things really hurt.
In my head, your first thought when you hit the ground was definitely, oh, I didn't get the segment.
It was. Okay. Yeah. I was like 20 seconds from the end and I had been at 175 heart rate and then I was just so close.
No, at least you didn't experience the abyss.
I know. I was going to get it too. But actually, so I had a little bit of hip pain, which is why I was riding. I think you've had some knee pain post. Yeah. We've been getting into a lot more strength training. And I think I kind of like aggravated my hip slightly. It wasn't a huge deal.
Yeah.
But I landed on it really hard. Yeah. I have like a hip pointer.
That has prevented you from running for a while.
Yes, exactly. And you know what? It got better.
Yeah.
I had like a chiropractic adjustment of 20 miles an hour and it somehow worked.
So is that the official advice of the SWAT podcast, is if you have any niggle, like, so for my knee, for example, I should probably launch myself off a second story window?
Yeah, maybe 15th.
15th story? Perfect.
Yeah, that might be more. You know, we've been talking about the idea that like, if you want to see something like in an early study, you should really just like set the bar higher and see what happens.
Okay. Yeah. Field testing it.
Yes. But no, I actually do think, okay, don't take me on this as science, but okay, I do think.
Wait. I also want to say for new listeners, we're talking to a doctor, not just a doctor, a double doctor. She has two doctorates, including an MD. So now continue what you're about to say.
This is not at all grounded in science. But I think my hip little like aggravation that was happening, I think was a little bit of an overuse injury.
Yeah.
And then I had a heck of a like trauma injury. It's like all purple and yellow right now. Yeah. And I think actually the trauma injury brought in some healing factors maybe I needed to recover from the overuse injury that it wasn't getting. And so, yeah, that's my very non-scientific theory that maybe you shouldn't listen to.
Okay, we're going to present this theory to Stanford Medicine, your alma mater, see if they take away your degree.
Yeah.
I love it. No, my preferred nomenclature is a chiropractic adjustment at 20 miles an hour.
Oh, yeah, it worked.
Yeah.
I would pay big money for that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Better than a lot of chiros out there.
Yeah. My bike's a little fucked, but you know, my body seemed to have come out better. So
perfect. And another thing that you mentioned that's really interesting is yesterday on the elliptical, the workout that led to you actually liking my book so far, you made a great comment. So you were doing this big workout, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 with half recoveries. So
it was brilliant workout design. You designed it. It was very engaging and fun.
Dude, you're all about me right now.
I know. I'm really feeling you.
My creativity.
Yeah. Your
workout
words.
Design.
Yeah.
Words, numbers. I can do it all.
You going bam on the keyboard.
Bam, bam. But while you were down there, I went down and talked to you. And I think this is actually an interesting way to tee up some of our discussion that we're about to have on tempo running, where, you know, when I'm, you know, talking to you, you're actually able to hold a conversation while doing threshold heart rate.
Which is rare for me because like, I feel like in the past I've definitely overdone the workouts. Like, definitely. I feel like for me, like I would finish almost every workout feeling shelled to the point that when you would come down to the pain cave, I was like so in it that I'd be like, get away. Yeah. Like there was almost this part of me that like I had to like exist in the pain and like I couldn't process anything else. And now I feel like we're taking this like more threshold based, really smooth approach.
Yeah.
And I'm just so much more open to just existing at threshold in a peaceful place, like talking to you, making jokes to you. And yeah. I feel like my physiology is really responding to it. And it's just so much more pleasant.
And I feel like that's one thing athletes don't really understand, which is why I thought it was really important to bring up, because even for you, you know, you're always tempted, well, the most output I can do in intervals, the better. So like if I'm doing high volume intervals, it limits the output just naturally, but you're still pushing really hard. And this embracing of peaceful existence at threshold, one, it makes workouts much more enjoyable.
Oh, it's so much more fun.
Two, it's so much better for your aerobic development. Mm-hmm. So what led to you kind of having that evolution to accepting that threshold doesn't have to hurt that badly?
Well, I think it was very clear, you know, I've had some health issues, and I don't think the health issues, I just got like an unlucky like genetic roll of the hand. But I think that certainly the training that I was doing was not helping them. And it was like, okay, like take me down once. Like, okay, like maybe we'll keep going. Take me down twice, then take me down 8 times. And I'm something has to change.
See, I don't learn. Like, I'm like, take me down 47 times, still shame on you. Maybe when we get up to 1,050, then I'll start to change my mind. But that's amazing. Like, and it also points out, I think, that sometimes these things, even when we're, you know, coaching some of the best athletes in the world and have gone through our own athletic journeys, it's hard to put into practice.
Oh yeah. I mean, it's a lot harder to like, you know, walk the walk than talk the talk. And, but I think also for me too, I was kind of dreading those workouts, and I got to the point where like, it was hard for me on workout days. And now I'm in this spot where like workout days are fun.
Yeah.
Like I really genuinely enjoy them. And I feel like you could give me any combination of numbers and I'd be like, sure, thumbs up. Like, let's do this, because it just feels very sustainable.
Yeah. We've called them big girl workouts.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Big ass woman workouts. That's what I want. I've been like afraid. I've like, you have to hear that in the context of the podcast to understand it's loving. So it hasn't been a Strava title yet, but I need to think.
Big girl workouts or big ass woman workouts?
Both.
Okay. We call them bam, bam workouts.
Even better.
That's like big ass. That's what we uplift on the SWAT podcast. The bigger the ass, the better.
Oh yeah. The better it feels.
Yeah.
The workout.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, oh God. What they call them in the NFL. So when the NFL is scouting linemen, they call them bubbles.
Oh yeah. I love that.
That you want to look at their backside and see if they have a bubble, because that projects their ability to develop long term. So Megan, I gotta say, your bubble.
How are those projections looking? You gotta make it scientific here. Is it gonna be a good 2024?
When I met you when I was 20, I was like, good upside. Good upside prospect.
And good backside too.
You know what? I think we transferred straight from that into tempo runs, because direct.
One more thing first.
Okay.
You've had a revelation recently.
Okay. And this is good. This is kind of similar.
This is related.
Because, you know, you evolved on your workouts and how you approach them.
Yes. And you've evolved as well. And I'm actually curious, because I feel like we talked about like the novel and your writing process. And I'm actually curious if there's like any overlap in this Venn diagram. So
why?
Okay. Because you might hate where I'm going here, but I'm just going to go. I'm going to do it. Is that okay?
Okay. I'm worried about this, but you can. You have permission to do anything on the podcast. So it's very easy to edit.
On last week's podcast, or the podcast before, I can't remember, you talked about the idea that you've had like some low level anxiety hanging out. Do you think that's had any like creative intersection with the novel? Like, do you think you would be writing the novel if you hadn't had that like existence of anxiety within your brain?
That's a great question. Maybe not, because it was a midnight revelation for me, like the whole idea of a plot. So my brain's working overtime for no reason. And sometimes when you work overtime for no reason, I guess maybe a idea bubbles to the surface.
Well, also there's nothing better for creating than anxiety.
Yeah.
It's also like a very shitty existence.
It's unfortunate,
to live in, and it's really not fun and it's uncomfortable. I get these like sometimes like big peaks of anxiety and then they go away rapidly. Whereas I feel like you have a more sustained anxiety thing, but it can be an outstanding form of caffeine.
Yeah. I've called it like Charlie the Chipmunk, where anxiety just kind of sits on my chest and kind of like almost internal in my sternum. And it's weird because it like has this like tittering feeling to it. So yes, it's kind of like the abyss.
That's a titter.
Basically, though, I'm not worried about anything. It's almost like it's directionless, which is almost the worst part of it. Like, it has,
well, I was going to say, anxiety for me that is not sometimes it's like when there's physical manifestations of anxiety and they're not tethered to like how I'm actually feeling. It's almost like the disconnect itself is strange.
Well, there's usually some sort of impetus that gets it started.
Yeah.
But then after that, it just kind of has a mind of its own and I have to wait it out. I would agree with your thesis there.
That's fascinating. But I think to connect the third point, which is where we're going, is we talked about the idea that like maybe you were inadvertently underfueling.
Yeah.
And I wonder if that was also related to some of the anxiety that you were feeling, because I feel like as you've embraced like some big ass, you've embraced some like big ass woman lunches recently, and it seems to have helped the anxiety.
Yeah. And I don't know. I'm not sure if this falls exactly in the, hey, sometimes you just need to bang your hip really hard to heal it framework. But no, I actually agree with you that, you know, probably I had found myself in a pattern of fueling that was not necessarily the best way to, you know, make my body healthy long term. Mm-hmm. And probably the anxiety that I was feeling has some hormonal relations related to the endocrine system.
This
we talk about,
this is where I was going, yes.
On here all the time with low energy availability. So, you know, before we get to tempo runs, a really good reminder to everyone is that, you know, sometimes you need to even when you talk about all this and you fuel a ton and you don't have any issues with necessarily like your daily fueling total, you need to sometimes think about and have someone like Megan to call you out and be like, David, your lunch isn't cutting it. Because for me, I would do protein shakes with cereal and I would snack a lot, but not necessarily the types of things my body needed.
Well, I feel like you were saving it up for this like big, like end of the day bang at dinner where you're like, I'm going to have this like amazing meal. But then during the day, it was like breakfast and lunch and second breakfast and second lunch were getting like negated.
Yeah.
And you've done a really good job now of being like, okay, we're going to have like legit meals.
Yeah.
And I feel like you've been more energized.
Yeah. So that's the lesson to everyone out there. If you're having issues about energy levels or even some low level anxiety, not like severe mental health stuff that might be like the lifelong struggle for you, but maybe acute setting type stuff. Just take a big ass lunch, a big ass woman lunch, just a bam, bam lunch. And for me, just over a few days, it's made a huge difference. And so what I've started doing is, you know, I have to have that protein shake. So I do the protein scoop right before lunch. So it doesn't fill me up too much.
Yes, yeah.
And then eat lunch. And I think it's going to be really good for my development. It's already seemed to help like my mental state a little bit, my hormonal state a little bit. So I don't know.
I'm really excited for you. But I do think actually, I mean, I love protein shakes, but I do think sometimes they blunt hunger. Like they make you full for longer periods of time. And then it's like sometimes the meals themselves become less solid in terms of like the overall like profile of it. And so I feel like you have to strategically do that.
Yeah, yeah. So right before has been really good for me. So one thing I'm worried about though, is you said my anxiety was necessary for my creativity.
Oh yeah.
And now my anxiety is much lower.
I know.
So Megan, what's going to happen to my brain?
We can keep it. I wonder if there's a way that we can keep it going.
No, we definitely can. I think often people think that, you know, wherever their context is, like with mental health, is essential to the good parts about them. And I think it's a part that creates the good parts to you, but the good parts persist long after you treat your mental health stuff. So, you know, for me, I've been trying to do a lot for my mental health generally, but sometimes those feelings might just be physical.
Yes.
And have physiological backgrounds. So, after this podcast, I am going to eat the biggest freaking meal you've ever seen. I haven't been impressing you out there.
I love it. I'm so inspired. Well, also I like to, because I think one of the reasons that you weren't doing it is because you always felt sleepy after doing that. And I was like, dude, take a nap.
Yeah.
Like, you know, work that into like your schedule, be a little bit more flexible with your schedule. And man, a lunch and a nap and some writing, getting sexy with those keys, the keyboard keys over there. It's going to be great.
It's going to be so good. Okay. Let's go on to tempo runs. This is a scientific breakdown because we've had listeners write in asking about what even a tempo run is. And it's a really fun opportunity to talk about training theory more generally, mix in some science, mix in some personal experience. Because, you know, running, when it comes to just going out there and running easy or doing your strides, like those are two elements. But how do you get to like race fitness, where in most races, you're going out there and running moderately for a long period of time, existing at that comfortable threshold? How do you work in specific practice, i.e. tempo running, where you're running extended periods of time at this effort? How do you work that into training?
And I love too, because we've already talked about threshold a ton on this podcast. And sometimes I feel like people get confused by like, what is tempo? What is threshold?
And sometimes they're used to synonyms.
Yes. And threshold is a very clear physiological point in terms of like LT1, LT2, lactate threshold, whereas tempo is much more of a term of art that gets used. And I love terms of art.
Terms of art.
There's like so much, like, I don't know, we can do so much with this interpretation.
Synonym. It's wishy-washy bullshit.
Yeah.
Every coach uses it differently.
That's true.
Which is why I think we have the most largely accommodating view of what tempo means, because that's how coaches use it. And it's important not to just narrow it down into one physiological definition. So lactate threshold is LT2. That's a very specific point on your curve. You can find it via, you know, lactate monitor or heart rate. Tempo is more about the idea of running sustainably but faster for an extended period of time. So
which can range like a huge variety of paces. Yeah.
Well, like, what's the shortest distance or amount of time that you might refer to something as a tempo?
Probably a 10K.
Yeah.
Yeah. Even shorter. It depends on the athlete's like pace and things like that.
I mean, but I would say 15 minutes could be a tempo.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, you mean like I meant like pacing. So,
Yeah.
So like I could see tempo ranging from like 10K to marathon pace.
Oh, honestly. In terms of paces.
Yes. Yeah.
Or even, I mean, honestly, even 50K pace for really advanced athletes could be, those paces could be called tempos. And then anything from even 10 or 15 minutes, probably 15 minutes is the baseline of what I'd say, all the way up to 90 minutes or 2 hours. Those things could be called tempos.
Or disjointed tempos, like, you know, do shorter efforts, toss some recovery in there. So all kinds of ways to get creative.
Yes. And that sets the stage for one of our favorite studies. We've talked about it on the podcast before, but it's a wonderful way to understand the importance of tempo running specifically. So it was in 2019 in the Journal of Strength and Conditioning Research called World-Class Long-Distance Running Performances Are Best Predicted by Volume of Easy Runs and Deliberate Practice of Short Interval and Tempo Runs. The structure here, fascinating. 85 world-class male runners did a retrospective training analysis. They took their training logs, questionnaires, things like that, and examined how well their different types of training predicted eventual performance.
And they did this over 7 years. Yes. So they have quite a lot of data, which is really fun to dive into and kind of create some of these regression analyses to understand how some of these variables might be important. But first, what I love is this like paper was really well written, is how they talk about deliberate practice. And I actually wasn't really familiar with like what deliberate practice is. So deliberate practice is, quote, according to them, a theory of practice that is conducted with a specific goal of improving performance and in sports requires considerable effort, concentration, and enjoyment.
Enjoyment.
I really like that piece thrown in there.
Does it require enjoyment to be deliberate?
No, I don't think so, but I think it should.
I like that they included the word.
I know, I do too. But it actually comes from, so a lot of the like research that's done on deliberate practice is done in musicians.
Okay.
And I thought that was really cool, especially because, so when we were in Aspen this summer, we were eating dinner and there was this like trio of musicians from the Aspen Music School that were there just practicing. And they embodied all three of these.
That's
like,
so true.
When you they were having just like so much fun, like messing up, like playing together, harmonizing. One of the guys was basically like, I fucking his cello. It was amazing. And I feel like that to me is like the definition of deliberate practice. And it's kind of ingrained in my head now forever.
Yeah. When you control F your life story, you should first write, did I fuck a cello? That's what you should ask the AI about your life story.
I'm not there yet.
You're not there yet?
No, maybe I should be doing something differently.
Yeah.
I actually really, I loved
music. You played the violin.
I did. I loved it.
Yeah.
And it competed with like sports time. So like the orchestra time and the like sports practice time was the same and they made you choose one. And I was like, you guys.
Maybe they make dildos that are shaped like violins.
Oh my God.
Seriously.
Oh, what about
rethinking the game over here?
Okay. It wasn't the violin that was super sexy to me. I never got to play it, but the electric violin.
Oh,
they make
yes.
them in blue violins. They're so great.
Oh, well,
they're on Riverdance and I saw it and I was like, I want to be her.
Perfect.
Deliberate practice.
Yeah. But deliberate practice is an interesting framework to set this up because I've never heard of that really used in running that much before or since.
Yes. And also, I don't know if they necessarily, I mean, they understood running, but they also said that easy runs weren't deliberate practice, even though it was forming the bulk of these athletes' training. And I was like, I kind of disagree. Like sometimes for me, easy runs require the most concentration and involve the most like
but
enjoyment.
I guess the comparison there would be for a musician that would be like practicing your scales or something like that. Like, I don't know music at all.
You do practice scales.
Okay. Practice scales rather than like what we saw the musicians doing, playing some sort of piece of music.
Yeah. Well, they could play any piece of music. They were just like taking like suggestions from the crowd. It was cool.
Yeah. So that's where I think it would vary. So like an easy run would be just kind of like practicing a background thing that helps you then for the deliberate practice.
Okay, very fair. But I feel like maybe scales in music are like the mitochondria in running. Like everything has to kind of exist on that point.
Or whatever the background is of how musicians develop the building blocks to then go crush, you know, an electric violin solo.
Yeah, actual musicians are like, you guys, this is so bad. Yeah. Everything except fucking the cello.
And then they're like, we do that every day and twice on Sunday. No, actually, on this podcast, we try to be pretty clear when we are experts and when we're not. In music, we are absolutely not. My brain
for sure not
does not work in that direction.
I want to be an expert, and I am so far from an expert.
I appreciate it so much. Like we've talked about how we watch these Drumeo YouTube clips.
Oh, so cool!
That are drummers just picking up music on the first listen. And I'm like, wow, human brains are remarkable. I appreciate it so much, but I have no fucking comprehension yeah. of what they're doing. It is incredible. Probably applies to my dancing as well. Okay, so the real money finding here is related to the correlations. So what the authors did is they tallied whether you could predict their outcomes based on these four different things: easy runs, short intervals, tempo runs, and long intervals. So easy runs started at the highest correlation, 0.72 at 3 years, down to 0.68 at 7 years, but still very high. So easy runs are the most important. Training volume, easy aerobic mitochondrial development, we always talk about that.
And for context, when you're hearing these numbers, we consider like a large correlation to be 0.5 to like 0.69. And so these are like very large correlations with easy runs, which makes a lot of sense based off of what we just said as like the foundation of mitochondria. And I think it's actually interesting though to see it drop over time.
Definitely. So it drops slightly, but in general, training volume is the most important thing and aerobic development matters. Two, short intervals. So 0.55 at 3 years for correlation, and then 0.56 at 7 years. So it seems like short intervals kind of have a steady importance in this cohort of athletes. It's a reminder that, like we always talk about on Swap, make sure you're keeping your speed high. That high intensity stuff, you don't have to worry so much about heart rate. A lot of the control stuff we're talking about, yeah, you don't want to race all your intervals because that'll break you down and it'll do some anaerobic development. But when you go out and do 1 minute intervals or something like that, you can get frisky with it, have fun. You don't need to be quite so disciplined as the discussion we're talking about today.
And I love that because it's like raise the ceiling and keep it high. And I feel like short intervals do such a great job with that.
Yeah. And then here's what we're mainly going to talk about today is tempo runs. They started at 0.50 at 3 years, but then 0.58 at 7 years. And later on, they do this discussion of statistical power where the tempo run change from 0.5 to 0.58 was by far the strongest predictor of what changes as an athlete progresses from the 3 year point to the 7 year point. That's pretty fascinating. So tempo runs start kind of important, but become very important as these athletes, you know, accelerate to world-class level, which is where the study cohort was being measured from.
And I think it makes a lot of sense too, when you think about that too, because tempo runs, like for me, especially if you take like a beginner athlete, I think tempo runs increase importance as the athlete's running economy. And as the athlete becomes like is able to develop more power through the running stride. So they're actually getting a lot more out of some of these extended sessions.
Yeah. So like doing a tempo run when you're a beginner runner, it's like, well, you're going to not be going nearly fast enough. You should probably dedicate that energy to doing shorter intervals or something that's going to raise the ceiling enough so that your tempo runs have a little bit more wiggle room to develop and play around, and you're not just using a ton of energy for slower paces.
And very similar for like an elite or advanced athlete coming back and like restarting a new block. Like if they're thinking about like, you know, coming off after like winter base season, it's like, no, let's like raise the ceiling. Let's keep the ceiling high. And then let's like gradually progress in these tempos as you're becoming more economical and more efficient.
And that's maybe one of the things that matters a lot right now, even outside of this discussion, is sometimes when we talk about base building, which at least in winter up here in the Northern Hemisphere matters a lot of people lose sight of the fact that almost every single professional level base building cycle raises the ceiling at the same time.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Like if you just do easy training, eventually you're going to get slow and that becomes an issue. Okay. And then the final thing that's just an interesting wrinkle here is long intervals. So, designed here as, you know, things over a kilometer in length, but still at moderate, at hard intensity. So this is saying, you know, at short intervals, we're saying it doesn't matter how high your heart rate gets within a certain range. Long intervals in this study mean things that are over a few minutes long and you're getting your heart rate very high. Those things started at 0.27 correlation at 3 years and then 0.22 at 7 years. So in other words, doing your long intervals or your long efforts too fast probably relates more to regression than progression, which makes the frame of this discussion so important because in tempo runs, we're trying to embody this controlled, sustainable, moderate style running, basically no matter what your effort guideline is.
And I think if you run the risk of, if you do a tempo run too fast, you're actually throwing it into that long interval category. And I feel like the wiggle room like area is not as big as we expect, especially for like professional and elite level athletes.
Yeah.
And this is where, so we're going to have a discussion later on more on continuous lactate monitoring.
Yeah.
I think actually that's a big reason why we've seen so much explosion in growth in distance runners is that we're not on tempo runs. We're not progressing into areas of long intervals too often. Like there's a much better way of actually making sure that we're like, you know, treating this well and not going too fast. And that's through continuous lactate monitoring. But
damn, it takes discipline.
Or not continuous. We're still at the point of like just spot lactate monitoring. Yeah.
Yeah. But, or even without lactate monitors right now, the understanding of how to pace this type of thing is so hard.
Oh, it's so hard.
I was thinking back to my journey and I remember, so it makes sense in a deliberate practice framework to be like, I should be doing more deliberate practice all the time.
Oh yeah. It's like, it's also sexy too. Yeah. You're like, I'm getting gains. Like this feels good. Yeah.
And so what I did actually, I don't know how much I've told you about this journey, but when I was in college and had just gotten into more serious running, I think it was a few years in And I hadn't been developing that much. I was like, you know what I'm going to try? I'm going to try running just kind of like a tempo run almost within every run. Because I'm like, this makes the most sense. Having not really been taught training theory before. Long before I was a coach, long before I developed a full understanding of the history of this field. And not only did I get slower, at my first race after that, I had the worst stomach issues of my entire life. And it's what led to a long medical journey of getting diagnosed with things. But at the same time, it was like my aerobic efficiency had gotten so poor from pushing these tempo runs too hard that my blood just could not stay in my digestive tract. It was terrible. And you had a different experience because you did these things called Megan runs, we talked about before, yep. Where you went out and just kind of ran moderately a lot. And it seemed like it worked pretty well for you. And I kind of wonder where that divergence is. Maybe it's just your talent or maybe it's somewhere else.
Well, I think it's because, so I started doing these Megan runs when I was a field hockey player and yeah. I was like thinking about walking onto Duke's track team. And I remember going into the track coach's office and he was asking me about like what I was doing for training and yeah. like some of my times and things like that. And I legit word for word told him, oh I was like, I just go out the door and run like pretty hard every day. And he looked at me and he was like, okay, like yeah. this is a little strange. But I think the reason I was able to do that was because I had the field hockey background. I was doing so many wind sprints and yeah. really like my ceiling was pretty high at that point that I think I was getting a lot out of those like longer efforts. Plus I was doing cross training too. And I think I was getting like some of the base through cross training.
Plus talent is a motherfucker.
I don't know
and
about
you're
that.
Very talented. But I also think, and this is where my theory starts to coalesce a little bit, is that in those Megan runs, which is what we called them at the time, you were doing them longer. So they were almost an hour or so, I would say, probably. Mm-hmm. Maybe a little bit over, maybe a little bit under sometimes. Whereas the things I was doing was 15 or 20 minutes.
Which were probably bordering on long intervals.
Yes.
Yes.
And not just that, creating tons of lactate, tons of anaerobic stress. Whereas your long things, because they were so long, had to be largely aerobic by definition, mm-hmm. because you can't push that much harder than lactate threshold for that long of a period of time. So that leads to a unified theory of tempo running, I think, here, which is when you're doing shorter tempo runs, which you can incorporate into training every other week, every other third week, something like that.
What is your definition first of shorter tempo runs?
I would say 15 to 30 minutes.
Yep, agreed. Yep.
Be a little bit more careful about effort in those.
In singularity, like how would you describe sometimes on long runs, I'll give like 3 by 15 minutes. That would be like a series and segmented chunk of shorter tempo runs.
Yes. For those, even more important.
Yes.
Because then you're just becoming long intervals and you're going to get deeply fucked if you go too hard. So in these types of efforts, really focus on control, like really emphasize that you want to get to the end feeling comfortable. They're amazing for fitness building, but the goal in these is not to run as fast as you can. That's for your strides, maybe a little bit for your short intervals, depending on your stage of development, but especially for beginner runners, do not race things that are 15 to 30 minutes long ever in training, unless you're doing a specific time trial that's designed to improve your neuromuscular and biomechanical function, where it's like shocking your brain. Otherwise, you only want to do that in extreme moderation.
And to give someone kind of some guideposts in terms of effort, I think Z3 and Z4 is classically what I would consider
in a
five zone model is what I would consider classically like a tempo effort. I think for beginner athletes, like working up into Z4 is great. Where sometimes for advanced athletes, like you can get a heck of a biomechanical stimulus out of like Z3 and sometimes even like upper Z2.
Yeah.
And so I think it really depends on like the caliber of the athlete, but it's just helpful to have those guideposts in terms of like how should this feel and where should my heart rate be?
And heart rate's a great way to judge this. Essentially, mm-hmm. if your heart rate's getting too high, and I see this all the time in athlete training, I'm like, well, if you do 4 by 10 minutes, let's say, or 4 by 3 by 15 minutes, and your heart rate is hitting above threshold or at threshold, or you're seeing rises across the interval right at the end, it's like, you're going to get fucked.
Oh, yes,
as the study points out, I mean, mm-hmm. that's pretty common around the training theory at this point. But so you can do those shorter ones, maybe every couple weeks, but then longer tempos. We've talked about this before. One of the biggest parts of actually putting your fitness into race practice, where you're ready to race. And for those, you can be a little bit more playful with Megan runs. Like you keep it controlled, you get good with steady running. But you know what? If you end a little bit harder, I think you're a lot less at the margins and at the edge because you're not falling into the long interval cohort or mix of things that this study points out could be very bad for development.
And in terms of how to structure that, I love using this on long runs. So having like the last hour at progression effort or things like easy, moderate. So there's like a couple different cues that I give to athletes. And I kind of sometimes play around with those cues so that they're getting varied stimuli too. But I think like, again, like those longer efforts are a great way to think about it.
Yeah. Okay. So before we move on, do you have anything that you think is helpful for listeners on this?
Yeah, good question. I think so an athlete is just getting into this and they know their heart rate zones and they're thinking about going out for, let's say, a 30-minute tempo.
Yeah.
How would you describe that to them in terms of how it should feel and how they should pace it?
I would say moderate to moderately hard, 1 hour effort. Mm-hmm. So by the end, you do feel some resistance, but you need to be comfortable and peaceful at threshold, as you described on your elliptical workout.
And it's okay if like the last like 2 or 3 minutes has slightly less peace. Okay.
It's okay. If you put less effort, it's different than if you start hard and fade a little bit or start hard and just survive.
But if you can get to a place of like 95% peace, that's a great place.
And progression, maybe that's the best way to end this. Progression is your friend on these. Like you ease into them, you go a little bit faster, perfect to do in long runs. Do this type of thing every other week for shorter ones, every longer ones before races, maybe every 2 or 3 weeks or 4 weeks. And mix that in, you're going to get a lot of benefit. And I think be kind of fun, as they said, enjoyable in the study.
Yeah, exactly. Well, actually it gets back to our 2024 words of the year.
Yeah.
Mine was huzzah and yours was revenge. And I feel like the first 25 minutes can be huzzah, should be huzzah. And it's okay for the last 5 minutes to be some revenge. Not too hard though. Don't wander up into Z5, but
that's perfect.
Yeah.
Awesome. Do you want to get on to Patreon questions?
Let's do it.
Okay. So as always, these are questions from listeners. If you join our Patreon, we answer tons of questions there. It is super fun. I think people love it. Here's the question. Thank you for your amazing podcast, sexy science and humor, and for the gift of your vulnerability. Megan, when you talked about scooping, I've never laughed harder and appreciated you so much. I'm just getting into coaching and thinking more and more about training structure. How do you structure men's versus women's mileage and training intensity distributions differently? Or are they even different?
And we've actually never talked about this before on the podcast. Yeah, we've never talked, like, how do we coach male versus female athlete differently in terms of mileage, or do we even?
I think we've talked about this before. I think we've talked about everything before. I think there's no topic that we can't get to. It's like The Simpsons. We've done that before.
And sometimes listeners are like, yeah, we get it.
Yeah.
Okay, but I don't think we've done this enough, if that's fair. And it actually really dovetails into, so some of what we were talking about came from a 2022 article called Training Characteristics of World-Class Distance Runners. And here they were looking at, so they were able to access these world-class distance runners. And they were looking at how men versus female world-class marathoners were training. And what they found actually was that the female marathon runners were covering only 5% less distance.
Yeah.
So 10 kilometers, but they were actually training 30 to 40 minutes longer than male athletes, which makes sense given that, you know, for female and male world-class athletes, the females are going to take longer to cover that mileage.
Yeah.
And they estimate like 10%, but I thought it was curious.
Yeah, it's a really interesting wrinkle because the study we were talking about from 2019, that was just on male athletes.
Yes.
Yeah. So we should point it out, it might not apply perfectly one-to-one. This 2022 study follows up, also looks at female athlete training. And essentially they pose the question. So since women train a little bit slower on average, if they're equally as good as a male athlete, they'll train a little bit slower.
And their on average estimation at the world-class level is 10%.
Yeah.
And I think it's a little bit different, actually. I think that number increases when we talk about trails because there is more of a strength component to it. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, the definitely. And you see this in races too.
Like yes, yeah. The stratification is
more. Stratification becomes more across gender in trails than in roads.
But it decreases as the distance goes on.
Exactly.
Yes. Yeah. It's kind of interesting to think about that.
Yeah. It's very cool because I think it just shows where maybe some inherent gifts lie for both genders, and it can vary and both can be gifts. But I think one thing that maybe that study is missing a little bit is that in general, the average like female athlete versus the average male athlete, the average female athlete will have lower bone mineral density and a greater susceptibility to endocrine disturbance. So for me, when I'm thinking about this question, I'm like, all right, in general, the average man versus the average woman, the average man will be able to sustain more volume just because of one, they don't have the menstrual cycle to worry about.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Guys can, maybe I would have been missing my menstrual cycle with my lack of big haunches.
Well, it's actually interesting. I think reds sometimes in female athletes has a much larger drop off in terms of the symptoms and how it impacts their bodies. Whereas male athletes can sometimes sustain that.
There's
a little
more
bit
margin
longer.
For error.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Exactly.
More wiggle room. Yeah.
And when you don't have margin for error.
Because testosterone is a hell of a drug.
It's a hell of a drug. Yeah. Talent is a motherfucker and testosterone is a hell of a drug. Two of our statements.
Yeah.
But you know, when guys have more margin for error, you can push the limits a little bit more and get comfortable with, hey, even if I step up to the edge, there's this net there waiting for me, which is testosterone.
Mm-hmm.
And you can still go beyond the net.
What a gift.
It is a gift.
It'd be so nice to have a fucking net.
Yeah. But for women, there ain't no net.
Yeah, exactly. And I think actually this brings me to the point is I think for me, when I think about how I structure mileage and training for female athletes, I think it's so dependent on individual factors and individual variables.
And that we're talking average man, average woman.
Yes. There's more for me, there's more variation within individuals than there is within genders.
Yeah.
It's just that my female athletes, because there's less margin for error, they do tend to be lower mileage on average, but some of my highest training athletes, like mileage wise, are females.
Yeah.
And that's because they've been resilient. They're like feeling their bodies healthily. And so I think there's so many individual characteristics at play and that you can't look at it from like a population gender cohort level.
And similarly, some male athletes don't have a net.
Yeah.
Or the
net true. Yes.
Goes in and out depending on how they, you know, progress over time. And same, the trajectories can change. But I think, you know, to get to the question, volume generally a little bit lower in female athletes for the most part, and more cross training.
Yes. I mean, you look at us, your volume is probably 2 times higher than mine.
Yeah.
Sometimes even more than that.
Granted, but that's, I think, individual variability.
Exactly. But it points out that that's more an individual variation than a gender difference.
Yeah. So
yes.
Maybe the best conclusion here is our whole point with training, no matter where you're at, even if you're a beginner runner, even if you're doing 5 miles a week, push the limits. Mm-hmm. But you know, if you understand a little bit about your physiology and, you know, where you're at with your menstrual cycle for a woman or where you're at with your sex drive for a man or whatever, it'll give you hints about how much you should be comfortable really going to the edge of those limits. Because for a male athlete, you can go over the edge and maybe the downside will be, oh, you need to eat bigger lunches and, oh, you should just dial back training. Maybe you're off for 6 weeks or something for a stress fracture. And it can get more severe, but it often doesn't. For women, meanwhile, the edge can be a little bit more harrowing.
It can be an abyss.
It can be an abyss. Well, not an abyss.
Because
No one's dying.
David's like, save the abyss, please.
The abyss is mine and mine alone. I'm not giving that to any girls. Girls out.
What about me?
No, even you don't get the bit. The abyss is just for me. But great question. And I think, you know, there are women out there that do very high volume. Mm-hmm. We uplift that for and that's awesome training. We're just talking about averages here.
Yes. And I think my secret is at one point in time, I used to resent the fact that you could run so much more than me. And it
I
was
remember
hard.
Trying to hide some of my doubles.
I know. And I remember one day driving home from med school and you were out running around the neighborhood. And
you got out like 3 hours early.
I know. And it didn't appear on Strava. And I was like, fuck that man. Yeah. What is he doing? And it was hard. Like I was like, I don't have the net that you have. And it was frustrating. And I've reached so much more of a peace with it over time. Like, I get to do more cross training. I get to do more strength training and it looks different. And that's totally okay by me.
And it's also connected to your superpowers,
right? Yeah.
You're more talented than I am.
No,
I
don't know about that.
Absolutely, Megan. You're more talented than Taylor Swift.
Okay. That is not true.
At least at running. Yeah. Everyone's talking about her running training.
I don't know.
Recently.
She looks like she could crush an ultra.
And they talked about her treadmill workout.
I don't want to face her on a start line.
That's the official position of David Roach, is that Megan Roach could crush Taylor Swift at a 10K.
Only on a Strava segment.
Okay. Next up. I'm a pediatric nurse and have been reading about NSAIDs, so non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs like Aleve or Advil, and how they impact the healing of bones. I am wondering your thoughts. Is this just in our pediatric population, or does it happen to adults too? How should we think about NSAIDs in the setting of running if it does apply? Would you say this needs to be considered with the impact of running, or is it specific to injuries? I don't really use NSAIDs often, but as I'm postpartum and thinking more broadly of long-term health, I just wanted to know your thoughts.
I love this. And we definitely have not talked about this on the podcast. I'm sure about that.
Yeah. Well, it's actually interesting. And we have talked a little bit about NSAIDs.
Yes. And actually NSAIDs, we should couch what they are first, because I told an athlete to take them the other day and he's like, I had to Google it, which is very common. So NSAIDs, ibuprofen, Advil, Aleve, aspirin, like so many different versions and types of NSAIDs, but essentially
also prescription versions.
Yes. There's meloxicam, which I actually take for arthritis. So all kinds of things. Athletes use them for pain, for sometimes for recovery and healing. And that's what we're about to get into.
Yeah. So what is the theory for why they impact bones? Because I've heard that too. But I haven't necessarily seen the one-to-one impact in practice that this listener's talking about.
Well, the theory is that they might risk of bone malunion or just decelerate the healing process. So the way that bone heals is there's this like initial inflammatory process, and that is then followed by bone production and then bone remodeling.
Yeah.
And the theory, and it's actually well supported in research, is that NSAIDs limit that initial process of inflammation, which you need to start the bone production and the remodeling. And so it kind of like, if you don't have that first stage, the other two stages are just become slower and less effective.
Interesting. So,
but you could also make that theory then for like muscles and tendons and other things. But I think bone for me is a little bit special in that inflammatory process.
Can I make a very important comment though?
Yes.
So NSAIDs cause that, but you know what else causes bone production?
What?
The bra you're wearing. Bone production. No, so I guess insects don't cause it. Almost landed. Not quite. I tried.
I liked where your ship was going. Yeah. As soon as you said bra, I was like, oh, we're in for something special. Yeah.
You could tell when my eyes lit up like that. Yeah. Kind of went back in my head like a shark.
I was like, what could this be when your eyes lit up? I was like, it's either bam, bra, or boobs. These.
Or Training Theory.
Yes, yeah.
I'm really into that.
Or mitochondria.
Yeah, so the theory then being that NSAIDs might slow down the healing rate of bone if you take them. Yep. Totally makes sense when you have a bone injury. I guess the question becomes, what about other types of healing processes?
Yes, I know. It makes you think about like muscles and tendons, even just like recovering from bouts of inflammation.
Yeah, and that's one place where personally, I don't necessarily agree 100% with this theory, just based on what I've seen in practice, where there's a distinction to be made between inflammation-based injuries and structural injuries.
Exactly.
And sometimes there's overlap.
Yes. And sometimes, but I think so much of what we see in terms of like, especially in the initial phase of like what feels like a muscular or tendon injury is inflammation based.
Yes. And when something's just inflammation based, you can be a little bit more liberal with things like NSAIDs because part of the healing process is getting the inflammation down. Mm-hmm. Whereas in a structural injury, inflammation is not the thing causing it. So if you're addressing the inflammation, you're actually addressing the healing response. So my prototypical example here is that my labrum looks so bad on MRI.
So does mine. And actually, to be fair, so does a lot of runners.
Mine looks worse than most.
I am the king of labrums and yes. Only me. I must own this for myself.
The doctor like audibly gasped when he looked at my MRI back in 2013. I think my MRI was productive for his bone production. Yeah. Based on that gasp, I'll remember it for the rest of my life. He said it just was totally frayed. Like it looked like roast beef. It was just like that was getting torn. And I was scheduled for surgery, ended up not getting it. And it's been fine since. And I think torn labrums, for the most part, though there can be structural elements of it. So when there's structural elements of it, like your bones just don't overlap. Often that's when surgery is needed and they shave down the bone in there when there's impingements that are really bad. But since most runners, something like 50% of runners are walking around all the time with torn labrums, the question of whether it becomes symptomatic, if it's not structural, is it inflamed? Yep. And in those cases, things like, you know, NSAIDs or even cortisone injections and things like that can be productive, even though you might not traditionally talk about them in a healing framework.
I love that. And actually, I love the other day you were talking to an athlete that needed a cortisone injection. And I think cortisone injections, when used strategically in very specific locations that are not risky, can be, as you described, like injecting 5,000 NSAIDs right into your, like, where were they injecting it?
Into their knee.
Yeah. And knee is a great spot for a cortisone injection, typically like lower risk.
Yeah. So our general answer here is if you're worried about a bone injury, don't take NSAIDs.
Yes. Yeah.
And even if you're a little bit worried, don't mess with them. But if you're at the point where like it's not on a bone, it's something that's a little bit, you know, wishy-washy and all I need to do is get this inflammation down, doing something like a 3 to 5 day course of low dose NSAIDs in the morning and evening can be productive, but talk to your doctor. Like Megan is a doctor. She's not your doctor. I don't know shit. And you know, be careful with it because it can also royally fuck your stomach. Like I can't take them at all because of my stomach. I wish I could because my knee would heal in a few days, I'm sure. So be careful.
And be careful taking it within close proximity of racing for that reason.
Yes.
But then also too, I feel like ice has fallen so far out of favor that when I recommend athletes ice something, I feel like I'm in like the ancient doctor times. I'm like, I'm using like, but I feel like honestly for me, like 3 to 5 days of NSAIDs and icing, I've seen athletes really recover.
You know what? And that's actually a good wake up call for me. I should be icing this knee.
Yeah, you should.
You know, all of this gets back to the framework for inflammation that pisses me off so much because it's like, okay, on one side, there's a like biophysical exercise science cohort. On the other side, there's the real world.
Oh, yes.
And it's like,
there's a huge mismatch.
And there's a huge mismatch because, you know, on the exercise science side, basically everyone's like, inflammation is your friend. You shouldn't be doing these things just to specifically reduce inflammation. Look at this study on athletes for 6 days that measured hypertrophy or something. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the real world, you know, athletes often in sports like basketball or whatever, or football, athletes pop this stuff like candy. And I don't think that's wise. It's just pointing out that like the mismatch there of what the best athletes in the world do versus what some of the science says is likely indicative to longer term processes and healing that's really tough to measure. So be careful with this. Also, we're not going to get into NSAIDs in racing. That's a whole other topic.
Oh, yes. And actually, people probably don't want to hear. We shouldn't say our hot take on that topic.
We should not.
Yes. People can infer probably.
We don't recommend it.
We don't recommend it.
But we have seen it overlap with things that we're not comfortable to talk about, and that like good performances, and that always leads us to be skeptical of something. It's like, it's kind of interesting to think about how painkillers could influence performance.
And I would never, ever suggest it. But again, I have seen really strong performances. And so it's kind of a hard thing to talk about. Okay, final point is prednisone.
Yeah.
So not a lot of people, actually not a lot of doctors like dealing with patients with bone injuries or bone stress injuries even think to talk about like NSAIDs, but also prednisone is another medication that really impacts bones. So it actually even goes further. So it reduces collagen synthesis and it can also like impact the integrity and strength of new bone formation.
Yeah.
And so if you have a bone stress injury or bone injury, also don't take prednisone as well.
Yes. And if you have to take prednisone, just be aware that there could be, you know, bone health risks for it if you take a bunch of it long-term.
Yes.
And if that's the case, it's good because like, you know, you need to take prednisone for a lot of conditions. Like Megan probably would not have been able to have a baby without prednisone because of the autoimmune condition. But at the flip side, we have to be more careful. So when her hip hurts, whereas in the past she might be, you know, I'll be fine to just jog through that.
Oh yeah. I haven't had a stress fracture in like 13 years. Yeah. I had one of my foot back in college. But now I'm like, shit, I was on that prednisone. Yeah.
You were popping that shit all day, every day. Because you had
I know.
To.
Yes. And it has longer. So NSAIDs don't necessarily have like longer term impact on bones, but prednisone does. And so I think if you're an athlete, be careful with it, like limit use unless it's really necessary.
This is just one of those areas where personal experience and really deferring to your doctor and health professionals makes a lot of sense.
Yes, I love that.
Okay, next question. Final question before we get to news and fun things. In college swimming, the men's team would always say they weren't allowed to have sex in the 3 days leading up to a competition.
Lame.
Saying that it affected testosterone levels for racing. Now, my partner jokes that we shouldn't have sex the day before a big workout or race because it does something to his testosterone. Is there science behind this, or is that all kind of urban legend? I feel like you two are the ones to ask when it comes to questions in the intersection of sex and racing. So I'd love to hear your thoughts. What a good brand for us to have.
I know, the intersection of sex and racing.
Yeah.
It's great. And sexy science.
Yeah, sexy science.
I know, we can throw it all in there. But we actually have talked about this before on the podcast. Yes. But you know what? I think it's so important that we need to talk about it again.
Yeah.
So and that's because it is an urban legend.
Yeah.
Have that sex.
The people have studied this very directly. The studies we're not going to list here, but it's what you would imagine with study design. except it had men masturbating. And
did it really?
Yeah.
Oh, but that changes things vastly.
Why?
I mean, the difference between like masturbation and full-scale sex is huge.
In what way?
I mean, there's like a much more physical component of full-scale sex.
Okay, sure. But it depends how you do it, I imagine.
I know, but you could instruct people very clearly. Okay. You could be one of those postdocs that's like, turn your ass around. Could you imagine? You'd be so good at that. You'd be coaching.
I'd just be there and I'd be, all of a sudden, I'd have a boombox.
You'd be like a wrestling coach, like on the floor of the mat, like, go, go, go.
I'd press play on the boombox and be like, you can do it. Put your ass into it. I mean, this is interesting. Shouldn't be an issue at all. I would say just be aware of, you know, how you incorporate societal like things that you've heard into your life. Also be aware that individual variability probably does exist.
Yes. Yeah.
And if you respond poorly, it probably matters. But I like the old thing that they used to say about, like, I think it was like Mickey Mantle or Yogi Berra, some player for the Yankees said, sex doesn't affect my players. Staying out all night searching for it does.
That's a great point. Yeah.
And so I think that likely that same thing applies, and just, you know, relax with it. Have fun in life. Don't force it, but have fun.
I think find your individual data points. And this is an area where you can fuck around and find out.
Yes,
you can. You can do it for the science.
And one final thing is just on this generally, this is a very serious thing. Is everyone goes through different cycles in sex drive, or sex performance and things like that. And it's something that isn't the scope of this podcast. Maybe we'll talk about it more detail in a future podcast.
We should, for sure. Yeah.
But be aware of those things because they are often signals for things like what we talked about today, red S, things like that. And there's no shame in it. It's just how the body works. Like, you know, there are some people that are ready to go all the time. They are the outliers, not the common point. And I think sometimes society, movies, things like that portray a view of like sex drive that is totally different than reality, particularly for athletes. And so give yourself love, give yourself patience, talk about it. Do not think you're different if you have issues in those areas sometimes. I think if you take that weight off, it'll make this whole thing much more easy to talk about.
Well, I love that you brought that up. And I also think too, we're talking about testosterone in the context of men's health here too, but I would love to do more science on testosterone in the context of women's health and endurance running, because I actually think it's like an important field that's not talked about enough.
Definitely.
And so I think that would be really fascinating.
Yeah. And I think sex drive and sexual function should be way more commonly measured in exercise physiology studies. Those postdocs that are playing backseat windows up, that's the way you're going to fuck for this study protocol. But I think that type of thing is important, not necessarily where you're at, because everyone has different baselines, but how your baseline changes. And
it's okay for some of that to change sometimes with training. Like, I remember we were joking once about like sex 7 days a week, twice a day. And we're like, oh, you should just train harder. If you have to have sex 7 days a week, two times a day, maybe you should just increase your running volume.
Yeah. Yeah. But again, it points out everyone's different.
Everyone's different. Exactly. Right? Like, yes. Yeah.
You know, I need to get my testosterone checked because like, 7 days a week.
Oh, that's not the norm.
Even 7 days
at all. That's nowhere even close.
That sounds to me like
work. Yeah, that sounds exhausting.
It sounds like
I really like to sleep.
I'll need a planner.
I know.
I'll need a planner. I'll need like refueling.
You'll need like an Aura ring. Your Aura ring and be like, what are you doing with your sleep? Also, you can't have a baby. Yeah, it's that would be a lot. Again, you should just up your training volume. If there's so much testosterone that you need that, just run a little harder.
Hot take right there. Okay, on to news and fun things. Oh my God. We're an hour in. The people that hear that are only on our side.
I know. Our safe space is like 45 minutes in.
Yeah. But speaking of sex function.
Oh, are you going to Athletic Greens?
I'm going to Athletic Greens.
Oh my gosh. It's so good.
And as we said before, we didn't get pregnant until I started taking Athletic Greens and take a little bit of time off of running due to other reasons, due to a niggle. Maybe the key here is Athletic Greens.
Oh, it's also just like the good stuff for creativity. We've been talking about like creative juices flowing. Yeah. I actually like time it now with my creative endeavors. I'm like, I need to write today or I need to podcast today. And I take it right before.
So go to the link drinkag1.com/swap, SWAP. It's linked in the show notes too. There, click unlock offer and you'll get bonus product. You'll get vitamin D. It's great stuff. We love it for athletes. It supports adaptation and it basically replaces a multivitamin. All you need to add is iron. So really like it, really like the company. And that's a great way to support the podcast.
Also, I think it's tasty.
Yeah.
I'm coming around, except for the last sip, which is heinous, but I'm like, I need like the final drops of it.
I think I nailed that promo.
You crush it.
I tied it to fertility, sex drive, and then you brought in taste.
And creativity.
Perfect.
Yeah. It's like all of life. Those are like my four pillars of life.
Plus Nesquik. That's yes. My fifth pillar. That adds in there. Okay, on to news and fun things. The first is an article on continuous lactate monitors, which is one of our big predictions for 2024. It's by Swap listener Jim Cotton, writing for Velo. Follow Jim Cotton. He writes great articles at the cutting edge of training theory. But a quote here I thought was really interesting. The smart people will get these and have a period of time where they do absolutely nothing with the data. Just collect it, look at it, and start to understand where everything sits and where your normal is, and then go from there. And this was the director of applied science at Super Sapiens, which makes continuous glucose monitors.
Actually, it's fascinating because I feel like continuous glucose monitors are kind of in the same category as like, there's just this like wealth of data. And I feel like we're not at the point right now where it's like really easy to draw conclusions from that data. And I imagine the same thing will happen with continuous lactate monitors. And it might be easier though.
I think it'll be easier because the science on lactate is so much more developed than the science on blood glucose.
Yes.
And how that varies.
And granular levels of blood glucose. Yeah.
No, I did see an interesting study that we didn't include in the outline because I thought not 100% relevant, is one of the main ways that continuous glucose monitors have been used is to detect overreaching because the responses to, you know, glucose introduction really does dictate training quality and whether you're going too far. Mm-hmm. So maybe right next to, you know, continuous glucose monitors, we can have like a morning erection
meter.
Meter. Like maybe that's measuring kind of similar things.
Well, this research has suggested just staring at data. And that's what you should do. You just like stare at like the morning erection tally adding up and be like, uh-huh.
But I mean, to be serious, that is actually a good, thing to look at for yourself. So back to continuous lactate monitors. I think that these are going to change the game. We're not exactly sure what type of data they're going to be giving yet, because right now we're so used to data that isn't doing continuously. You're doing spot checks after 1200 meter intervals on the track. This could look different. So when they come out, we're going to be right on the cutting edge of how to use them and we'll keep you updated.
Well, I think it's really going to inform pacing, because if you think about it, like if you have like a lactate spike, that's like you can look at those particular lactate spikes and figure out the best pacing mechanism. And they are going to be illegal in competition within UCI, which I think makes a lot of sense. Like, I think it's kind of like an unfair game to have athletes have access to these. And I totally agree with that.
Yeah. The UCI really against continuous monitoring, but they turn a blind eye to EPO.
Interesting. Yeah. That's an interesting framework to follow.
Maybe not. I just remember from reading Tyler Hamilton's book called The Secret Race, where UCI essentially took him in and was like, you know, we'll sweep this under the rug for you if this, and it's kind of how Lance Armstrong's positive test for corticosteroids got swept under the rug too. So interesting lines to draw, but I'll be fascinated to see where this goes. We'll keep you updated.
I also like it. I like continuous lactate monitoring, the concept, a lot, because it's a lot, but I feel like right now we have all of these different ways to approximate continuous lactate monitoring. Like we have heart rate, we have power, and all of those things are impacted by so many different variables, which Jim Cotton does a great job of describing in this article. Things like hydration and altitude and temperature, and like continuous lactate monitoring is just a much more direct way of looking at that. And I think whenever we can get more direct and dive deeper into like more specific levels of physiology, like we're going to unlock a lot more as to how we think about training theory.
Yeah, and I don't think it's just going to be elite athletes either.
Oh, no, yeah.
Probably most important for athletes just starting out, because the lactate curves can be kind of inverted with really high initial lactate levels and resting lactate levels. It'll really point out sometimes the benefits of aerobic training. And
also, those curves are, when you're a more beginner athlete, they change faster too.
Yeah.
And so I think understanding the evolution of your curve is going to be like really helpful for beginner athletes.
Here's one more projection for 2024. So we're going to see an explosion in easy running because these lactate monitors are going to point out just how much some of these lactate curves get fucked over time. If you do things like Meg running, when we talked about, or David's tempos, like those types of things can put you down really nasty lactate paths.
Yeah. I'm also excited too to see its intersection in medicine.
Yeah.
So doctors often like shock. So like when a patient is in shock, their lactate levels go sky high.
Interesting.
And if you have a continuous lactate monitor, you can actually understand how a patient is responding to like medications and even things like putting volume in them through IVs and things like that. So I'm curious to see how it like finds its way into ICUs and in hospitals and things.
Doctor, I'm not in shock. I just did a 3-minute Hill interval.
Yeah. Which actually I wonder, I mean, it makes sense. Like, you know, when you think about the lactate levels of like people in shock, which can be like 12, like if athletes are able to like handle that much better.
They've talked about that, that athletes are able to handle surgery better usually because they are better at handling lactate. Their body's more accustomed to it, but an area of research that's limited still. Okay, next up, something we teased last week. This is from JAMA, the Journal of American Medical Association, Internal Medicine. It's called Comparing Physician and Artificial Intelligence Chatbot Responses to Patients' Questions Posted to a Public Social Media Forum. And it's the ultimate study where David, the guy with no background, came and dunked on Dr. Megan.
Okay, because it's, you're so pro AI. And
I'm so pro AI.
You added this to the, you added this, but wait.
You know who I asked
the about? Listeners are going to, we're going to go through the study and then we're going to determine who dunked on who.
Oh, you're going to so lose this, Megan. You're getting into a fight. You're a doctor. This is kind of about doctors. You're getting into a fight with a lawyer.
I know.
You
fuck
don't
me.
Get in fights with lawyers.
I'm on the side of healthcare providers. You're on the side of AI and you will probably win, but I want the dunk to be decided at the end, not now.
I'm on the side of machines and lawyers. Yeah, does everybody love me now?
Oh man.
Okay. So basic structure of this study is there was the Reddit hashtag or slash Ask Docs subreddit, 195 questions. This was done in December 2022, so the original phases of ChatGPT, not the new ones that are much better. So that's another point in my favor.
Okay, but point in my favor is people are going to Reddit for medical advice.
And it's the best place.
Just think about that context.
I also like Reddit for medical advice.
Yes,
which I trust Reddit more than a doctor. They evaluated the quality of responses. So they put the doctors versus the chatbot. The chatbot was preferred in 78.6% of situations. And it had 9.8 times higher ratings of empathy. So one of your big, you know, things that you're pushing back against is that humans have empathy, machines don't. And my point is actually machines have more empathy than the experts a lot of the time.
On Reddit.
But yes. Anywhere. But this is just a microcosm of experiences that everyone has with doctors where, yes, there are amazing doctors, but often doctors have to go through so many patients that the consequences of missing something are felt a lot more. Whereas when you're talking to a chatbot, it gives longer responses. It gives more nuance, more empathy.
Okay. Well, I'm going to go through what the questions were posed on Reddit because I think it's actually fascinating and a curious point here. So two of the questions just to highlight like what people were going to ask about their medical context on Reddit. The first one being, it was a question about the risk of dying following swallowing and ingesting a toothpick.
Uh-huh. Good
and
question.
So this was the point where like the AI chatbot just gave a longer response and it was like, I'm so sorry you think you're dying from a toothpick. Whereas the doctor was like, here's X, Y, and Z. And then the second question was a question about needing to see a physician following injury that occurred by hitting a head on a metal bar while running, resulting in lump on head, headache, and sore neck. So
those are great questions.
Would you ask that question on Reddit?
Yeah, for sure. That's a, I mean, totally you know, either time any of this happens, you're kind of urgent. Do you go to emergency room?
When you swallow a toothpick?
Yeah. I mean, I swallow things all the time. In fact, I've said this before, but Defector, one of my favorite sports websites, has an annual post. What did we stick in our penises this year? But it also talks about everything that you've stuck in different orifices.
Okay, but here's my question. Is the chatbot going to extract that object from the penis? Who is going to do that?
No, but you need to – the question isn't who's going to do the procedure. The question is who is going to give you the type of context that allows you to make decisions for your health.
Okay, that's partially fair because if I had something stuck in my vagina, I would totally ask ChatGPT going to the emergency room. But all of the like answers that the AI gave at the end, it was like, you should see a healthcare provider. Yeah. So we're just we're coming back full circle to humans every single
only
time.
Only because they're programmed to do that. If you program this thing to give more confident responses, it would. And you could actually program those types of things.
But I think still, if you tell like AI that you have something stuck in your penis, 99.9% of the time, it's going to tell you to go see a healthcare provider to get it out.
Hey, and are you planning to stick the electric violin up your vagina?
For sure.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. I just was not going to get it stuck. Yeah. I'm going to do it well.
And I agree. Yes, I just think that it points out that, I mean, obviously see a doctor for everything. Doctors are amazing. They're the smartest people in society. We're just joking. But it does point out that I think the intersection of how AI influences every field is not quite understood by people that downplay the ability of AI to mimic human emotions. Mm-hmm. And mimicry of human emotions is indiscernible from human emotions, mm-hmm. to the point that aren't they the same things? Aren't all of us mimicking human emotions to a certain extent in developing our personalities? That's what Leo is doing right now, watching us behave.
Which is scary. But I also think that what you say to a certain extent is true, because I think, yes, I agree that AI was, when I was reading his responses, I was like, yes, AI is more empathetic. I would agree with this. But I think the limitation is it's on a Reddit thread. It's online responses, and AI isn't going to go extricate things from orifices.
So what I hear is I agree with you, but here's a thing the study doesn't even talk about.
Well, it's I agree with you. I think you made a layup. I don't think you dunked. Which I consider a win because I'm up against machines and lawyers. And so it's like, deal. We got to take like the soft layup.
And again, AI, the reason we talk about it so much is it is changing everything. Be constantly aware of it. I'm coaching a coach who is using AI much more prominently. Mm-hmm. And I'm asking him to write an article about how he's using it. Similarly, if you're writing a novel, AI is a great place to talk about plot and ideas.
Have you asked AI?
I have. And I haven't used its ideas yet, but it's given me ways to think about the problem. Since I'm trying to subvert a genre, mm-hmm. It's given me ideas of like, what is the genre even? And like, where can characters develop and things? So basically, this world is going to change a lot. Pay attention. And you know, if you get a toothpick up any of your orifices, see a real doctor, not Reddit or AI.
I love that. But to be fair, when you fed AI like your article, was it sitting in a bathtub drinking kombucha post-elliptical workout?
But the thing is, you can make it do anything you want.
You can make it sit in a bathtub. That's true. It'd probably very gladly sit in a bathtub.
Imagine you're sitting in a bathtub. You can make it do those things, which is why, you know, obviously the things that are user-facing us in the athletic realm, let's say, those things are as simple as it gets, the things that they're using for this. When it gets programmed and applied in appropriate ways, the limitations of this type of software that can connect all of human knowledge at once are basically non-existent. And so I think what we're seeing right now is not a limitation in technology. We're mm-hmm. seeing a limitation in imagination. Mm-hmm. And I include myself in that because like I haven't used it at all for athletics yet. But imagine what happens when you feed continuous lactate data.
That's going to be exciting. Yes.
One of these models that's appropriately programmed, which if you ask these models training questions, they're terrible because they're not appropriately programmed. But if you give it the right info, it's going to give you results that a human brain can never really come up with. So I'm excited for that person.
Okay. Well, I'll give you a high five. That's for your layup, but not for a dunk.
Okay.
I don't think healthcare providers just got dunked on, but it was a soft
layup. No. And I love healthcare providers. Yes, I think there's going to be a need for more doctors, not mm-hmm. fewer. It's just going to change which doctors we need.
And I agree on that. Yes.
You know, like maybe we're going to need slightly fewer radiologists and slightly more primary care specialists.
Mm-hmm. To communicate this information.
And to be the people that facilitate it not fucking up. Mm-hmm. But did I win? You know what you're going to be? You should be, instead of saying I won.
What?
When Draymond Green loses, the forward for the Golden State Warriors won Defensive Player of the Year.
He decks someone usually, right?
He punches him in the nuts.
Yeah.
That's what you should do.
Close enough.
Did I win? Nut punch.
Okay. I think, I have to admit, I think you did one. You did win, but I think you won in overtime.
Okay.
On a layup. Yes. Right, yeah.
Okay. All right. This is a quick one because this is important, I think, for athletes. It's on creatine supplementation and long COVID. It's called The Effects of Six-Month Creatine Supplementation on Patient and Clinician Reported Outcomes and Tissue Creatine Levels in Patients with Post-COVID-19 Fatigue Syndrome.
And they took 12 patients who had post-COVID-19 fatigue syndrome, and they gave them 6 months of day, 6 months of 4 grams a day of creatine. And that's like kind of the average. I actually take creatine and I take 5 grams a day. So it's like right around the like average dose that you would take for creatine.
Yeah. And basically the reason we just wanted to bring it up really quickly is if you're dealing with post-COVID issues, which for all we know, Megan's heart stuff could be related to that, but probably not. But a lot of things happen in, you know, the COVID land, and you see a lot of nonlinear responses that we never saw before COVID became a thing. It might be worth considering, if you're dealing with anything, even not direct long COVID, to consider creatine supplementation, because this study found that after 3 months of intake, fatigue-related symptoms went way down. This includes breathing difficulties, body aches, headache, difficulties concentrating. And at 6 months follow-up, all of that went way down even more. So basically, creatine supplementation could play a role here, though who knows, it might not be one-to-one direct. It's too small of a study to really draw those conclusions.
And this is the first study looking at creatine supplementation for COVID, like post-COVID patients, which I thought was, I was like curious how it's just coming out now. Like I feel like creatine to me is used in so many disease processes and states that it was a little surprising. But one thing that I found that was interesting that we definitely need a lot more research on is that there's a lot more creatine being like taken up into the brain. Oh. And their theory is that like COVID itself might cause a possible dysregulation of the blood-brain barrier.
Interesting.
Leading it to like be more susceptible to taking up creatine for like brain metabolism and other processes.
Wow.
And so I thought, I mean, I think whenever you see a finding like this, and then there's like a plausible biological mechanism right next to that, it like, it makes me more excited.
Especially when our nervous system is involved.
Yes. Yeah.
The brain. Mm-hmm. Like I was, again, this is quackery and not something that I would ever bring to the podcast, but I was reading something.
I love it. You're like, not something I would ever bring to the podcast, well, but here it is.
In a serious way.
Yeah.
And just proposing something that is fascinating to me, because whenever nervous system is mentioned, it pricks my ears up because it's something we don't really understand. And it involves back pain, mm-hmm. where there's these theories of back pain that I do not share, of some types of back pain, that it has such a large nervous system response that if you address the nervous system underlying issues, you can help cure some cases of this chronic back pain that's rather mm-hmm. debilitating.
Yeah.
And there's some studies that show really interesting findings on specific types of patients. So maybe our brains are involved a little bit more than we sometimes think in acute disease processes, and not just acute disease processes, also things like training. Mm-hmm. You know, like when we talk about fatigue and long events, you know, when we talk about the caffeine and using caffeine strategically, a lot of that probably is we're thinking about how the brain has, you know, governor related responsibilities for lots of different things, including things like possibly some fatigue that you're feeling after being sick.
And I think it's also like, I love thinking about the idea that the brain is not necessarily like a closed system either. Yeah. So, I mean, there's also other things like other systems within our body that impact the brain. So like the microbiome, how it impacts the brain and then how that connects to the body.
Yeah.
And I feel like we're still starting to uncover a lot of that. And I'm excited, like very excited for some of these findings ahead. But one thing I wanted to know on creatine. So I take creatine for like, I feel like it really helps with like muscle power generation,
autoimmune,
like preventing inflammation. And I've learned that I have to take it with carbohydrates.
Interesting.
Yeah. Which make, given the mechanism, so carbohydrates help creatine, help muscles like absorb creatine better.
Yeah.
But also for me, like if I don't take it with carbohydrates, my stomach gets so jacked up.
Yeah. Well, thanks for sharing your story. I
think yes.
It helps people to hear that you're taking it because I think there's still a stigma around creatine in general. It's starting to be lifted.
In the endurance population. I think that's more of just like a bodybuilding thing.
I think in general too, like for me, it felt so much like when I was growing up, it just felt weird. Mm-hmm. Like it felt like something that wasn't a vitamin. But I think what we're seeing more and more is creatine is just enhancing maybe natural processes that can be depleted in some instances. So like I don't take it, Megan does. And we've seen athletes have success with it. Pay attention if you're dealing with anything like this. It could really help.
Yes.
Okay. Do you want to do any more studies?
Let's go. We have so many good secrets and hot takes and listener corners. So can we go to those?
Okay.
So we can spend, we have so many good studies ahead.
Oh my God.
What are you getting sad about missing?
The listener email about the protein studies that we talked about last week.
I know. We can save it.
We can save it. Okay. Yes.
It's coming ahead. There's going to be some good stuff.
We're skipping like 9 of my favorite topics right now to get on to hot takes and stories. But you know what we're going to talk about first?
What?
Jonji.
Oh my gosh. We are going to talk about Jonji.
That's the bra that helps with bone production.
Oh, uh-huh. This is the best bra in existence. Yeah. And I wear it like a lot, like an embarrassing amount. It gets washed very rarely. It's the Pace bra. It's kind of like a halter top and my pecs are growing. I'm proud of that. I'm lifting a lot more. And for whatever reason, this bra makes it like really comfortable to have like fluctuations in muscle size.
Yeah. And Jonji is just so great. All their gear has this guarantee. It lasts forever. We've been using
it. So comfortable. Constantly. Doesn't chafe. Yeah.
I have the first pair of pants. You know, I love running pants. We talked about that before. I can put my phone in the pocket and it doesn't bounce around while I run because it's made for that. It's the coolest things ever. So go to janji.com, JANJI.com. And then there, use the code SWAP at checkout, SWAP. Janji is an amazing company. Supporting them also supports the podcast in this instance. And it's just great gear that you're going to love.
Okay. I was talking the other week about 3-inch shorts from Janji, which I ordered accidentally. And then I was like, when I lifted, I was like, look at all my tendons back there. I can see like everything. Did you know they have 2-inch shorts?
2-inch shorts.
I haven't even explored that possibility yet.
Oh my God. Do they make them for men?
A good question.
I think they should.
They might. We should check. You haven't. How have you not checked that?
I don't know.
You can do it.
I don't know, Megan. There's sometimes school buses go by. Be on a watch list if I wear those shorts. Wait, on to hot takes and stories. Here's the first one, a story I really like. Story. This is the first year I've come in DFL, dead fucking last, in a race, and it happened twice. But it happened because I'm more open to picking races just because they look fun. In the past, if it's been a choice between a 5K and a 10K at a location, I would pick the 5K because there will be more people out there going my pace. This year, I decided to go with whatever distance vibed with as long as I could make the cutoffs. Huzzah for aging, maturing, and NGAF, not giving a fuck.
I love this even more than I love the acronym NGAF. Yeah. That's great. I feel like if you're not doing something in life where you're finishing DFL, you're not putting yourself out there enough.
Yeah, and reminder, every year, rededicate yourself to failing or quote failing or finishing last or not finishing. Like those are signs that you're pushing good limits mm-hmm. that help your emotional growth. Like before we were talking about physical limits, and those are good to push, but be careful because there can be some long-term downsides. But like the emotional growth that happens when you don't necessarily meet your expectations or you get comfortable not letting external validation and results define you, that's massive. And it can lead to such cool places. So this might be better than any race win of all time.
It's so cool. Is there something where you want to finish GFL this year?
Novel.
Yes. I love that.
That's the whole point. Like, yeah. You know, what's been liberating is I decided it could suck.
Yeah.
And in doing that, I've allowed myself to start and it might very well suck.
Okay. It's not sucking.
But you like me.
Yes.
You like my vibes.
That is fair.
This is very me. It's me to an extent that mm-hmm. might cause an overdose and vomiting and nausea and diarrhea. You might need Pepto-Bismol after having this much of me.
You might need to go to the emergency room if it persists for 5 hours.
You can ask actually
ChatGPT about that. Yeah.
But that type of thing, it's just been essential for my intellectual growth. Mm-hmm. And obviously training wise, like you need to fuck up. You need to mess up. And you know, you need to learn that waiting for you on the other end of that is love and joy and all of the things that make life meaningful, that you aren't your external results. So huzzah to this listener.
I love that.
Awesome. Next one. Hot take. Add trail running to sports betting apps.
I love this. Yes. Except we probably have insider trader going on, but for sure.
Yeah. Oh my God. We can make so much money.
We could make so much money.
Like Black Canyon.
Okay. Yeah, but we shouldn't do that.
We have some secrets at Black Canyon.
I don't know. Would it be like insider trading or just really believing in our athletes?
Insider trading for
sure.
Yeah,
that's for sure. Yeah.
I mean, it gets complicated because like—
Well, sports betting is like, is there a such thing?
Yeah, because in
football— Actually, that's true. I guess like coaches can't play. Yeah.
In football,
refs, coaches,
suspended Calvin Ridley, a star wide receiver for a year mm-hmm. for sports betting. Similarly, I think—
Was he betting for or against his team?
I don't know. I think
it's interesting.
It might have been other games. That's You're not true. Allowed to yes. bet yeah. on anything. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think similarly, if trail running was seriously added to sports betting apps, we would need to make sure we would need to have rules against people participating.
Yeah.
Which I is kind of crazy to think about because someone saying this is a joke, obviously. But I think if this actually happened with stakes, with money included, we would need to have a thorough system where the athletes themselves cannot participate mm-hmm. Or it risks going down really negative ethical paths. I even think things like free trail fantasy.
Yeah.
You know, athletes should probably not participate. Honestly, coaches probably shouldn't either. And I've just over time realized I should back off that because often when I did that, it was just a joke. I would just put all
swap athletes. But then sometimes you'd win. Yeah.
Well, no, I mean, not win, but the point being like, you know, just the fact of doing that, I think looks more like impropriety than I'm comfortable with. Mm-hmm. And if we're saying sports trail running should be a sport, then treat it like a sport and you don't want to be Pete Rose.
Yeah. Well, I love it. It also gets the idea that trail running is a participant sport. We talked about this before.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, if trail runners themselves can't participate or racers themselves can't participate, like the pool narrows so much to people that are participating.
I totally agree. Okay. Before listener corner, one more promo, and that is for Precision Fuel and Hydration.
Oh, it's so good.
So this is the big ass gels that we love. The fuel goes down so easy. It's this hydrogel form. It's what's made for food doping. It is so awesome. Try out their gels. They're amazing. Also try out their electrolyte drink tabs. Go to pfandh.com, pfandh.com. There, use offer code SWAP for 15% off. We swear by this stuff. It's great. On Patreon, you get a lifetime discount. So patreon.com/swap, where you get 15% off for life. It'll save you, you know, hundreds of dollars over the course of time if you subscribe there.
Okay. For some reason, maybe you're just like hiding them all or putting them in like a special drawer or something, but we're out of the 100 milligram calf gels. Oh. Where did they go? I like need them back in my life because like my life energy, my life force is different without them.
Well, based on the discussion today, I know an orifice we can check.
My orifice or your orifice?
Yours. You like them. I've had to actually reduce my caffeine since feeling a little bit of anxiety.
Has that worked?
Oh, I mean, it's been complicated. It's been a lot of things.
Yes, but yeah.
Whenever I do feel those, I do need to back off caffeine because it's not helping.
Yeah. Also, the 100 milligram caffeine sources are potent.
They're so good.
I'm like ready to go to the moon after
I have
those. Yeah,
if you get Precision 100 milligram, one of the best race sources of energy and performance of all time. Okay, on to listener corner. This is a beautiful one. This message is coming in a bit late, as I intended to share this story closer to the holidays for your special episode. I wanted to take a moment to thank you two for everything your podcast has supported me through over the last year. Let me just say that we have been on a journey. I discovered your podcast about a year ago after realizing that you coached some of my friends and deciding to pick up your book. I'd been in a dark time in my life since 2020 and felt my mental health swirling out of control. Your podcast quickly became a safe space for me and helped me reassert a healthy relationship with running as I tried to ground myself in life. Ultimately, your messages gave me courage to decide to quit my job and my career track and find a way to bring myself back to the geographic location I love. Ever since I opened myself up to that possibility, before even having a plan, a cascade of good things have flowed my way, including landing a dream job, going back on antidepressants, moving very far, and finding my first place, working back from injury and racing an ultra, falling in love, getting sponsors, improving my history of purging, of eating disorder behaviors. And I feel like I'm just getting started. I've listened to your podcast to support and inspire me through each one of these endeavors, from Megan's job interview advice, to saying yes to what is scary and shooting my shot, to keeping the long view of brick building in perspective, to uplifting my partner every day and building a relationship full of love and celebration. Thank you for reminding me, again in my 30s, that all it takes is the willingness to ground into what values are most important for you and identify the first next step that will let everything else fall into place. I can't wait to see what 2024 holds, and a preemptive thank you for accompanying me on my journey as it continues to unfold. Huzzah.
That is beautiful.
Right?
Also, what a journey. That is like an epic adventure of a, like a multi-day stage race of a journey. It's amazing.
Especially, what I love here is thinking about the really dark times in this listener's life, which might have started in 2020, but then it sounds like they kind of really hit ahead in 2022 mm-hmm. or even at the beginning of the year. If you had told that person that at that moment that they were going to be sending this email, they probably would have been like, you know, slap me in the face and punch your mother. They'd be like, no, that's not going to happen. And, you know, I think it points out that sometimes just showing up a day at a time mm-hmm. can lead to really cool places, but you got to give yourself compassion. Like the type of compassion you would extend to your very best friend in the whole world, it needs to go to yourself first, because when you're in that dark place, that abyss that you're feeling, it just feels like there's no way out. Even if it's a little bout of anxiety like I had, and you just take a step back, be like, all right, I'm going to find my way, but the way to do that is through one step, not through 100 unthinkable steps.
I was just about to highlight that part of the email, the first next best step, because I love that phrase of just like, just take the next step and the next step and the next step. And I also love that geography grounded some of those steps. Like I feel like geography is a really underrated part of life decisions. And it's like, no, go like where your heart feels like you're on trails and you're at home and you're surrounded by like community. And I think that element is so underrated.
Where they make round splinter-proof violins.
You don't want splinters. Where did they make those?
Well, it's just you want ones that are more based in like plastic silicone mm-hmm. than wood.
Yeah.
Because wood is generally not a good thing.
Do you know where I feel like they make those?
Where?
Vermont.
Vermont?
It's because last night we were watching Noah Kahn together. Yeah. And you typically like, you used to not like Noah Kahn. You were kind of a hater. And now you've
been
like-
Well, I didn't know him. I judged him just from his album cover.
You're like, it's sad boy music. And you know what? You loved it.
I loved it so very much.
He had like the biggest Vermont vibes going. Yeah. And now I kind of want to go to Vermont and find that violin.
I don't know if necessarily the lesson here is to move to Vermont.
I don't think it is.
I don't know if that actually, will
this
help
person might have moved from. You're talking about a long journey.
They moved out west.
Yeah, I was going to say, for me, when I think about a long journey involving positive mental health, it's moving from East Coast to West Coast, unless it's a tiny corner in Vermont.
Yes, where Noah is singing to us yes. with his wonderful wordplay.
Where he's fucking his cello. Does he play a cello? I don't think so. But I bet you he could.
Banjo.
Oh, that's even better than a cello.
It really is?
Yeah. What would you like better, a banjo or a cello?
Or a violin.
A violin.
Are we bringing in all the wood instruments? Like, where are we drawing the line here?
All of the wood instruments.
Okay. Well, I'm just going to go direct and say clarinet.
Yeah.
All right. Let's all play a tune. And actually, we should make it a little bit deeper because it's of what it's
you know how we so- usually like harmonize together? I don't know how to build off that tune.
Do, 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 do. It's probably a lot
that's
more
like the French horn.
answer. The correct answer is the French horn, and we love you all.
Woohoo!
Huzzah!